form is you know, mechanically, you want it to be able to stay there. You know, I use a heavier half-inch cord, you know, Dacron cord. You know, it's got, whatever you buy, it's got to be resistant toward the sun, you know, UV protection, all of that. And it's got to be a little on the slippery side to be able to move on these branches. That's what I use, right over the branches. And also the insulated side. You know, you can go to Ace and buy any length of, for instance, I use 1.5 inches PVC. You can buy any length. If you went in there and told them I want 1 foot, they'll give it to you. And, you know, I take a pipe cutter, and I make nice 1.5 inches. I take the length 1.5 inches pieces, so they become the insulators. See this on all my dipoles, and then that piece, and now when you cut it, you have a rough, you know, edge on the inside. I happen to have a Dremel tool. I'll just hone that out. If you had a reaming tool, so that's fine, but the Dremel tool is the way to go. This way you have a smooth edge all the way around. That's where the rope goes. But the wire I drill holes into the insulator, maybe about 1.25 inches apart from one another, right for the side of the pipe. And then again, with the Dremel tool, I hone them out, especially on the inside, and this way you have a smooth surface. When I put the wire through, I circle it back, and then I'll twist it to itself, and you know, make it where it can't come out. And the way I set that, I just twist it around to make it so it can't untwist. Let me drop it. The heat shrink tubing, and put that on the wire first before you put it through the insulator. And now it's, you know, this maybe 3-inch piece of heat shrink tubing is sliding along the wire. When you after you put the wire through and you twist it, I slide the heat shrink tube back over it. Just heat it up with a hot air gun, and that thing will never untwist forever. You don't have to re-solder it to itself or anything. It's heat shrink tubing acts as a grabbing mechanism, so that it can't untwist. And that's the way I set up the, you know, I think mechanically it's got to be set up where it doesn't come down. You don't want to be going out there in the middle of the winter like I did last year. Back to you, Dale. Oh, yeah, I got to make a comment. 1 second. I'm fine with listening to antennas forever. No problem. So many times here, too, I missed actually some of the antenna discussion. I'll be reading about trying to edit the SpaceNet report. So, you know, and I'll be reading that. And I'll, you know, you'll be talking, Dick, and sometimes it's going in one ear right out the other because I'm concentrating on something else. So not too much of a chance for me to really ask a question like this and get a good answer. I know it's basic, but I think it's important. Back to you, Dick. WS2N.
Okay, I thank you for that comment, Paul. Before we go over to Mr. TDN, he's got a question. I know that Russ wanted to make a comment on the subject that's on the floor. N2XJN, K2RIW, go ahead, Wes.
I do very much appreciate Hal's input into the internet. He's the guy who is trying to have the most of the answers in the shortest period of time. But I disagree with Hal completely. We do need more about antennas. Let me drop. And that is simply because this subject is not easy to understand. A plenty of people and a new people, especially youngsters, who grow up, and this community is simply dying out. It's a community of dinosaurs. If you don't like it, go to hell. Stay for your turn. Or find others who will support you. I don't. And to exit.
I thank you, Wes. one other point that I'm going to make on this one, and that is when it comes to antennas in our backyard as ham radio operators, it's one of the areas where we can do a lot of homebrewing. In a case of an 80 through 10 meter transmitter, very few of us build the transmitter or build the receiver anymore, but a significant percentage of us build the antenna. So discussing antennas is something I think is important. And when it comes to the commercial world, where you're hiring engineers that you want to do antenna work, most of the time you're going to be hiring the better engineer if you hire a ham radio operator. He's the guy who's got the hands-on experience with antennas. I think Eric wants to make a comment on this one also. KE2EJ, a man who uses some really big antennas, K2 in his broadcast work, K2RIW. Go ahead, Eric.
K2DUX.
Sorry, I started out with one comment, but now I have two. First one is for Paul, and I'm looking at his RF, but when he talks, his RF drops. If you listen to him, you can hear a little bit of hum maybe. It's time for him to take caps in the power supply. And the other comment that I had is, you're the moderator of the venture here. And if somebody has an opinion that's contrary to what you think is what's being called for, because you don't get started on antennas unless somebody asks a question. So, you know, if they don't like listening to it, they can tune to another channel. Right up your cage, we got.
Yeah, thank you, Eric. Mr. KUX, go right ahead, sir. I think you had a comment.
Fast comment, Dick. Thanks for sharing your antenna knowledge with us. Once somebody makes the end-all, be-all, perfect HF antenna, we won't need to talk about them anymore. KC2TUX.
Okay, I thank you. Now, I know that earlier we had somebody named blank2TDN. It sounded like Tango Delta November. Please correct me on your full call, sir, and your name, and then proceed with your question on the subject on the floor right now. Mr. TDN, K2RIW in the TechNet. My name is Dick.
TDN. I talk about a power supply. A deep cycle battery. Is it dangerous to use a deep cycle battery with a power supply in your house? Talking about hydrogen exposure? I'm talking about that. And that's what I want to hook up.
Okay, were you the person that signed in just at the beginning of the antenna dipole discussion that said you had a further comment or a further question on that? Who was that person, Mr.? It sounded like TDN, TVN, I'm not quite sure. That person, please give me his call letters and name right now, K2RIW.
This is Freddie, B2, Victor. Bravo, Nancy, in Far Rockaway.
Okay. When you signed in, did you sign in earlier, like about 15 minutes ago, Freddie? Did you want your question about batteries to be put on the list of questions? Go ahead there, Freddie.
Hey, Roger, that was me trying to get in.
Okay, you're on the list. You've got Joe is ahead of you right now. W2RYY, patiently waiting. He's the guy 2 weeks ago... Yes.
The guy you're referring to came in from the input.
Okay, I'm going to check. The Eastern input is operational right now. So that person with the Eastern input who signed in earlier, do you want to give us your call and name right now? K2RIW. Okay, maybe we'll pick him up later. Maybe he had called away. So Joe was the guy who was asking us the question, the wrong length of the monopole of the NMO connector, the Motorola NMO connector. And we started off not quite sure why the length was wrong, and we soon found out by way of the extra information given us by Professor Mike, WY2U, who, by the way, really is a physics professor. We were completely forgetting about the extra wire that's inside of the base of that NMO connector for Motorola. And it's got to be there for physical reasons, but Motorola did an extremely good job of making a rugged antenna, and that's the most important thing. If the antenna fell apart, no matter how good the performance is, we would say terrible things. But that antenna hangs in there very well. So B2RYY, are you you're going to rake us over the coals again with one of those tough questions tonight, Joe? You got it, Joe. B2RYW.
comment more than a question because, I was working on, my antenna model, which is going to supposed to simulate eventually, an HF multiband antenna. And my comment is, the model doesn't work according to the way you think it's supposed to work. Playing overlay, actually, I know you've talked about this before, but what I've made doesn't seem to follow the same theory about laying one antenna next to another one that's longer and progressively longer, and it's not supposed to affect the resonance of the other antennas with the shorter ones. But I actually found that it does that in a significant manner. Back to you.
Yeah, the way I worded it could easily have been misunderstood, Joe, and maybe I said it backwards. If I was building a fan dipole, and ordinarily to keep the coupling between the individual dipoles, an 80, a 40, a 20, and a 10, we'll say, and maybe there's a 15 in there in your fan dipole, if you fan them out wide enough, the amount of interaction between them is fairly small. However, what I was trying to say, and maybe I said it backwards, is that the lower frequency antenna, the longer antenna, is the one that is less affected, almost unaffected, by the presence of the others. Your 80-meter dipole, the one that's 132 feet long, sitting right alongside of the 40-meter dipole that's 67 feet long, if you measure the resonant frequency of the 80-meter dipole with and without the 40-meter dipole there, you would see very little difference. The 80 doesn't see the 40. The 40 does see the 80, without a doubt. The tips of that 40-meter dipole has capacitive coupling to the middle of the wire of the 80-meter dipole, and therefore it gets tuned to the lower frequency. You can make very close spacing in a fan dipole by readjusting the length of the higher frequency dipole. If that 40-meter dipole, instead of it being 67 feet long, was, let me pick a number, 59 or 60 feet long, with a certain close spacing to the 80, you would reestablish resonance. Let me drop. And as you can tell from that article that was in CQ Magazine by K2RIW, way back in, I think it was 2010, The Magic of Wireless was the name of the article. I think it was the March issue, 2010. The magic of resonance is what really does the radiating. The fact that you've got close capacitive coupling between your 40-meter dipole in this example versus the 80, which knocks the 40 out of resonance, brings it down to some lower frequency. And you make the 40-meter dipole shorter to reestablish resonance with that extra capacitive coupling. You will get 99% of all the performance back on the 40-meter dipole. Your highest priority is not to make a dipole at 40 meters that's exactly 67 feet long, or in your case of that 2-meter NMO antenna, to make it something that's exactly 19 inches long on 146 megacycles. I mean, wait. That length is not the magic. The magic is whatever length for your particular method of construction and deployment that gives you resonance. Your highest priority is to resonate at the center frequency of your intended band. Then all the magic of radiation takes place. The B2RYY, K2RIW in the TechNet. You got it, Joe.
W2RYY, Friday. Well, I tried to make the first of all, the model antenna using in my construction practice is made out of a wood T type of arrangement. I have a vertical member about 40, 50 inches long, and something a little less than that as far as the horizontal member on top. So I didn't want to use something metallic to try to, interrupt my readings here. Well, let's start with the first one I started. These are intended to simulate, the model. So the first antenna I put together, first section, was something of 7 inches long, and it gave me a resonance of about 292 megahertz. Okay, the exact frequency, it doesn't matter if it's out of the handbank, because it's not for discussional purposes. I'm just using this as a model. Just using two lengths of wire on each end of the piece of RG58 coax, and looking at an antenna bridge for its center frequency, I cut the antenna to resonate at the best frequency of 292. Center frequency I got is about minus 22 for return loss. Okay, you got that so far?
Minus 22 dB. I presume I'm going to put in units for you.
That's something in the vicinity of a 1.15 standing wave. I think it's 1.5. 1.15. Beautiful standing wave ratio. Go right ahead, Joe.
Minus 22, I believe, is a lot less than 1.5. It's probably closer, you know, like that's less than 1%. That's down that quite a bit, okay? Now, the next dipole, I laid on top of that. And by the way, this wire is all soldered. It's not twisted together. Whatever. I soldered it in the construction as I put each section on. It's soldered, so it has a nice solid connection. Nothing twisted. Nothing could be, you know, intermittent as far as that goes. The next section I laid on top of that was something that resonated about 420 megahertz. The final section was supposed to resonate about 146 megahertz, or as a target value. Less than that. Let me tell you what happened with the 292. The 292 frequency was minus 22 with nothing overlaid on top of it. When I put the other antenna at, I think I got a frequency of about 219 megahertz, and that gave me a return loss of minus 24. What happened to the 292 antenna when I rechecked it? The resonance went up to 350 megahertz, and I only got a minus 12, and it was a lot sharper in its Q, because the band was shrunk up a bit. Okay, you got that so far?
I was waiting for the beep. So you had a dipole-like structure supported by wood that resonated at 292, if I understand correctly. Laid on top of it in some manner was another antenna trying to resonate at around 220, and when you did that, I would have expected very little effect on the 292, and you said it moved to 360, and the return loss of minus 22 became minus 12. By the way, the minus 22, I was saying 1.15. I didn't say 1.5. 1.15 is what I was guessing, and we can rework out the math of that. So your 292 antenna went up to 350 of resonance. When you sandwiched it or laid on top of it another antenna, which I think you said was on 219, that's a bit different than I would have guessed. But without a photograph or a diagram knowing what you did physically, I mean, the words you've given of putting another antenna on top, boy, there's a lot of different ways I could interpret that mechanically as to how you did it. Over to you, Joe. W2LYY, K2LYW in the TechNet.
I don't know why you'd have to see a photograph of it. You know, it's pretty simplistic in construction. Just imagine one antenna overlaid on top of it, soldered at the same connection points for the coax cable, just physically above it, with the wire touching it, just like I'd have in a, you know, full-length, you know, HF antenna. So the 219 antenna was laid on top of the 282. Now, next on top of that, I laid one that with one pair of wires, I got the resonance of that one to be about 144.3, and I got a minus 22 return loss on that antenna. When I overlaid that antenna on top of the others, the 219 antenna went up to about 237 megahertz and had a return loss of about minus 9, best place in the band. Okay, follow that so far?
I follow that so far, appreciate it. And by the way, laid on top, didn't tell us the spacing. And you said they're connected together. Well, they're connected together at the center, at the feed point. Are they connected along the total length of each other, of these bare pieces of wire, or these insulated pieces of wire? It's clear in your mind what you've done because you've done it. The words you've given us so far doesn't make it super clear, Joe. Go ahead.
Not open wire, insulated, stranded wire. I believe it's either 14 or 16 gauge stranded wire. It's not dirt, you know. I think it's somewhere around that. Maybe it might be 18, but it's, you know, what I'm using here. But that's not terribly important. I know that it's going to affect the Q of it a little bit. But it's all insulated wire, strain of wire, silver plated type wire. So when I put the 144, the highest length antenna, longest length antenna, overlaid on top of the 219 and the 292, it gave me a return loss of minus 22. The 219 moved up to 237 at minus 9. The 292 was still about 350 megahertz, about minus 12. Then I overlaid a little wire on top of the 144, slightly longer, by about a quarter inch or so. Now what I had found out was very interesting. Just laying that wire over it. When I say overlay, it's physically on top of the other wire, not vertically, but laid going up on a piece of wood. The wood's about like a 1x1 piece of wood, okay? Or one inch by 3/4 inch, something like that. So it's, if you look at it from bottom to top, the bottom antenna is 292, the next one up is 219, the next one is 124. So you can draw a picture that way. So when I took the next section of wire and put it on top of that, now what happened is I got something that resembled a W as far as the return loss curve. But just simply one dip, it had actually two of them. And so with two wires, I now had not best resonance, but a figure of, at 140, I had a minus 18 dB return loss. At at 138.2 went to minus 22, and at 144.7 it went to minus 22. So they went a little better, and that's what I'm trying to establish on 80 meters to make something that has a little more wide band of a technique. And when I got done putting that extra wire on there, I went back to the high frequency, and the 292 antenna seemed to come down slightly in resonance to 336 megahertz at minus 16. So here's the problem. It doesn't work like you described. It was laying one antenna on top of anything. Well, the antenna has to change in length slightly. Well, I'm scanning the whole frequency band up and down by a couple hundred megahertz looking for other dips. And the interesting thing was, when I got the whole thing together, going up to about 440 megahertz, which is something, nothing was cut for that resonance whatsoever. I saw a nice, huge dip going down about minus 35, almost minus 40, at about 439 megahertz. So that's the whole thing looked like. I mean, I can't really send you pictures because you don't read my emails.
If I understand correctly, Joe, you're using stranded wire that you estimate is 18 gauge, insulated stranded wire. I'm assuming now that 18 gauge wire with its insulation is probably a 64th of an inch thick. And if you're laying these pieces of wire of various length on top of each other, and the only separation is the insulation, I think you're telling me that these individual pieces of wire are like a 32nd of an inch apart, because the insulation around each silver plated 18 gauge piece of wire, the only separation is because of the, I'm going to call it, rubber insulation. You didn't use those words. I'm slowly getting the picture. And when it comes to a fan-like dipole, you're taking an extremely extreme case of a very close spacing, even closer spacing than I would get with ribbon cable. I used to think a ribbon cable fan dipole is about the closest anyone would build. And if you're literally laying these on top of each other and taping them together, so to speak, or holding them together with tie wraps, that's an amount of spacing that very few people have used before. What you are discovering, I think, let me drop, is that there's lots of ways of making structures out of wire, and you've got a slightly complex structure that are going to have multiple resonant frequencies all over the place. Some of the resonances are due to the length, some of them are due to the local capacitive and inductive loading, some of them are due to other compound effects. You're now building a multi-resonant structure, and looking at the return loss is a very good piece of information. The next step of information, if you had the right kind of a antenna analyzer, is when you get one of these minus 9 dBm reflection coefficients, which by the way is a 2-to-1 Biswas, that ain't very bad. You'd like to know, well, what is the resistive component and what is the reactive component of that minus 9 dB reflection coefficient. Was all of it just a resistive mismatch? Was all of it just a reactive mismatch added to the resistor? Or, in the general case, it's some kind of a variation between the two. You are doing, you're trying to do what's called modeling, and you're building up this structure of various things laying on top of each other and trying to make sense out of it. I'll warn you, you're going down a road that's not easy to understand, Joe. I've been down part of that road in the past where I was forced by the conditions of somebody designing something where at the 11th hour they say, okay, let's slap an antenna on this, a handheld device. Oh, you got a cubic inch left over there. Give me three different antennas on these three different frequencies. To which I said, you got to be kidding.
times a naive project manager thinks the antenna doesn't require very much real estate, and he gives all the real estate away to the guys that are building the transmitter, the receiver, the power supply, the regulators, the control circuitry, the display, and there's a cubic inch left over, and he wants antennas in there, and he wants high performance. You're almost doing something like that. So,
repeater, timeout.
Did I misunderstand you, Joe, when you said it's laying on top of each other? Is the separation between these multiple pieces of wire only the thickness of the insulation? In which case, that's an extreme case, and analyzing this and making general rules of thumb out of this one, I think it's going to be kind of difficult. It's going to be an educational process, without a doubt, but you're going down a fairly complicated road here, in my opinion, Joe. To V2RYY, K2RYW in the TechNet.
W-A-2-O-A-Y. You're correct. Now you have the idea of what I'm trying to do. And making the HF antenna on the actual frequencies would be constructed the same way. I didn't realize you really didn't understand what I was talking about previously, discussing this several times on the TechNet. I thought you thought it was going to actually a fan dipole. And I told you that's out of the things I'm not going to do with that. I don't have ways of multiply supporting the thing. I want to do something supported just from, you know, the support from the center and each end. So now you have a better picture of what I'm trying to do. Unfortunately, it doesn't work correctly.
WI to you. I'm going to pick you up in a minute there. I'm going to pick you up immediately, Mike. But I also want to, I want Rich to re-give us the brand name and the model number of that antenna. This folded dipole-like antenna that's made out of ribbon cable that Rich N2EO brought to our attention 2 weeks ago. I made some guesses as to what it was, and when I finally went to the website of that manufacturer, and I can't find the notes on that one right now, it was an interesting structure which has multiple frequencies of resonance. I bet you've seen some of these crazy blips that you get on a vector network analyzer when you sweep from DC to light on various antenna structures. You think you've built an antenna for, let me pick a number, 146 megacycles, and it's got some slightly different characteristics of the mechanical layout, and now you sweep it far and wide, you're going to find all kinds of other resonances you might not have figured on in the first place. I bet you've seen some of that, but let's see if you can somewhat simplify what Joe is trying to do. I think he's going down a pretty difficult road here, Joe. I mean, Mike. WY2U. K2RIW. You got it, Professor Mike.
So we are, Dick. You want to grab Rich first? I'll stand by.
Yeah, Rich, what was the brand name and model number of that antenna that you're about to install, which I know is not 132 feet long. I think it's more like 80 feet long, and it resonates on 80 meters as well as a number of other frequencies, and I think it's got ribbon cable in its dipole-like structure. N2EO, K2RIW, you got it, Rich.
Okay, Dick, you can Google the company. It's Cobra Compact Antennas. Cobra Compact Antennas. It was recommended to me by KJI Electronics, who owns a company in Gene, W2KJI, in Jersey. And they got three. The one that goes furthest one. One of something feet more, too big for me. When I bought, goes to 80, 10, 73 feet more, which fits on my property, got 80 by 100 water bars and people apart. And then they get shorter one, I forget, I think it's 50 on feet, and it covers 40 to 10. Yeah. Made out of pork, and the animal itself is made out of four conductor rotor cable, and the feed line is the ladder line. So you need an antenna to it. Back to you, Dick.
Well done, Rich. That's the exact information I was looking for. So the Cobra compact antenna, the 80-meter version, which is made out of ribbon cable, and what they've done is to short together some of those four conductors of the ribbon cable at the far end, some of them, not all of them, and did some cutting and shorting at the near end also. When you look at the schematic diagram by going to that website of Cobra Compact Antenna, you'll see that the so-called 80-meter dipole is zigzag back and forth across the full length. And that mechanical crazy layout gives you a 73-foot-long antenna instead of a 132-foot-long antenna that does a beautiful job of resonating on 80 meters. And, oh, by the way, it happens to resonate on each one of the other ham bands between 80 meters and 10 meters. There's a lot of antenna in that simple structure. If you go to that website, there's a lot to be learned there. And to do an analysis of that, I think it could be quite eye-opening. And I didn't say it's going to be easy, but maybe Mike can make that easy for us. That'd be right through you. Here's a challenge for you, Mike. KQRIW in the TechNet. Go over there.
I have a comment, if that has to...
Okay, I'm not so sure I could do a complete analysis on it, but I think I have some comments. Good evening, all. I think what Joe might be seeing, and I'm going to call this a multi-mode structure. I think that's the word you may have used before also. And the way Joe seems to be describing this to me, Dick, is that he has, I'm going to say three modes, perhaps there's many more, but let me call his first primary mode of operation the so-called antenna mode, which, of course, is simply radiation. But because he has all of these wires very closely coupled to each other, there's also going to be a very strong transmission line mode where these wires are going to couple to each other so that currents are going to influence each other by being sort of equal and opposite, although not equally so because the antenna... And thirdly, because of all the... I'm going to say he has a directional coupling. That even in odd mode impedance difference, full equivalent resonances. Now, what Joe is looking at is quantity, return loss. If he was to put this like you mentioned before, I believe, in the valleys, he would probably find out that, well, while you may not get a very good match in terms of return loss, I think he's going to see several bumps that are going to correspond to all of the resonances that these various modes in his model actually are giving him. So it'll be a very difficult electromagnetic analysis at best. About the only thing I could offer up to Joe for you is that if you want to repeat this experiment, increase the spacing so that the wires are at least 3 to 4, maybe 5 times further spaced than you have them. Repeat the measurements, and I think you might be finding out that some of these higher order modes that you're seeing may be greatly reduced, and you're going to sort of tend to get the response that you want. Back to Nick there, Dick, WY2U.
Darn good, Mike, thank you. And while you were talking, I suddenly got a rush of brains to the head. What Joe is doing is going down a road where the method he's using is going to take him quite a large number of man hours to make all the measurements and try to make conclusions out of it, to sweep the frequencies and look at the places where the return loss goes to minus 22 dB or minus 9 or minus 6, so to speak. If you have access, Joe, and you've got access to some pretty good equipment, if you had access to a vector network analyzer, I know you've got the service monitors, with a good vector network analyzer, where you're making a Smith chart display, which really is a polar display, and as you bring these wires closer together in real time, in other words, you're moving them on your wooden structure by way of a long insulated wooden rods, if you know what I mean, so your body is not interfering with it. And if you could watch in real time the way the Smith chart behaves, and let me drop it. Assume your vector network analyzer is sweeping across all of the frequency region that you care about, which maybe in this example is between 140 and 320 megacycles. You're sweeping that frequency region, and maybe with some markers on the screen, but it's being displayed as a Smith chart. And now you see all of those slowly moving curlicues on that screen, as with the wooden stick, you bring the wires closer together, further apart, fold them back, make them longer and shorter. To see it in real time allows you to do, let me pick a number, 100 experiments in one day. Of all the antenna patents that my name is on, were derived in that manner. Real-time display, well-calibrated vector network analyzer with the right display, so as I'm moving things, as I'm bringing hand tools, a tuning tool, a tweaking tool, a wooden rod with a piece of copper tape on the end of it, and I'm bringing it near and far to various portions of the antenna, and watching in real time on the screen, and I was simultaneously displaying gain and standing wave ratio. With the right kind of a display, with the right kind of machine, you can make the experiment go many times faster. I recommend you consider that, Joe. I'll admit it's not easy. I'll admit it could be expensive. But you probably have enough friends, you've got the resources, where you may be able to start doing this with a complete display. And the magic of, let me get off the screen. The magic of that Smith chart display on a well-calibrated vector network analyzer is that you're looking at the resistive component and the reactive component displayed graphically, simultaneously, quantitatively, and once you learn to recognize, hey, if I do this, the curve suddenly jumps to the center, which is where the Viswell becomes 1.1, if you know what I mean. Or if I do this, it jumps out to the outer edge, where the reflection coefficient is minus 1 dB, and I've got a 40 dB standing wave ratio. When you look at that display, because the it's more than just reflection coefficient. It is the real resistive component and the reactive component is on that screen being displayed in real time while you're moving it. You're going to get a hell of a lot more experiments per time, and that was the advantage I used that resulted in all those antenna patents. Let's see what John has done, because I think you've got a vector network analyzer, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2WGB. Oh, yes, quite a few of them. Dick, a quick suggestion for Joe. I was working on something similar. Not exactly the same, but very similar problem. I wasn't doing three antennas, but two. And to cure that spacing problem, what I did was I used a piece of 300 ohm twin lead on each part of the antenna, routed them to the coax, and then I used a paper punch to trim the lower one to shorten it. And I found out, now what he could do is lay out, let's say, the top one of the 300 ohm twin lead, the length he needs, then cut it where he has his next section, and see if he has a similar reading on his instrumentation, and that spacing should be sufficient to gain exactly what you were talking about. I've done it before, and believe me, that paper punch is great because you can just nip a little bit at a time and go right down the line, and then when you're done, pick up K2UPS, he has a comment.
Very fine, thank you, John. And one of the magic words that that Mike just gave us is that yes, you are building a multi-mode structure here, Joe. By various lengths, various couplings, standing wave ratio effects, transmission line effects, directional coupler effects, resonant effects, radiation effects. You are mixing all of that together in one very tightly coupled, close structure. And so your multi-mode, multi-resonant structure is going to be giving you peaks and valleys all over the place. And so to make sense of it, it's not going to be easy, but this could be one of those magic places in ham radio where it's a tweaker's paradise. Some of those antennas that I've worked on, the antenna that I hold the greatest amount of bragging rights on, is this Yagi-like structure with three elements on 915 megacycles that's 3% wide, but my definition of width is where the standing wave ratio doesn't exceed minus 25 dB reflection coefficient across the whole band. A Yagi to do that, the analysis of how it works could drive you crazy just by tweaking in front of a well-calibrated, by tweaking for a reasonably small number of hours in front of a well-calibrated vector network analyzer, giving me a Smith chart display in many of these cases, and an XY plot of reflection coefficient and Viswar, blue and yellow curve as you've heard me talk about so far, by looking at real-time simultaneous display of gain and reflection coefficient. You suddenly find certain magic characteristics where you can't even explain what the hell it does. And yet there it is on the screen, and as long as the screen is well calibrated and telling you the truth, it's damn valuable information. When I finally resulted in those particular antennas that I'm talking about, that very wide band a patch-like antenna, the very wide-band, three-element Yagi-like antenna. You take these extremely wide sheet metal antennas at 915 megs, and you put it into an analysis program like High Frequency Structure Simulator or CST Microwave Studio. The modeling program cannot handle it all the way. It breaks it up into a whole lot of little finite element analysis, and it gives you a prediction of performance that's nowhere near as good as the reality. You're into an area with multi-resonant structures. You can fall into an area of great benefit where the theory of explanation is difficult. Don't worry about the theory. Tweak it like we ham radio operators do. We're very skilled at that. And when you get pay dirt, jump up and down with joy and let some other fool try to figure out what the hell it really is. Is it a Reed Solomon analysis of a vector network analyzer? I'm throwing names at you, if you know what I mean. Let's see what Rich has got to say. I wonder if you've done any of these kind of experiments, Rich. K2 Uncle Papa Sierra. And where are you located tonight? K2RAW. Go ahead, Rich.
Okay, Dick, good evening. K2UPS Mobile. I'm in Pennsylvania, a little bit south of Pittsburgh right now, heading back to New York. My only comment to Joe would be that he's trying to make a multi-band fan dipole type of antenna, but he doesn't want to or doesn't have more support for the different elements. That's not necessary unless he's trying to keep the bundle of wires so tight that it looks like a single wire for the visibility purposes, maybe to keep so that the neighbors don't notice it. But if he just supports the antenna via the 80-meter element and then suspends the other elements below the 80-meter wire. You could use short pieces of PEX tubing. You want to go really cheap, you can take strips of a plastic soda bottle or a plastic milk container, cut it up into strips, and suspend the other wires from the 80-meter. They don't need to be supported at the end. Just hang them from the other wire. You'll get a couple inches of spacing that way, and tuning will go a lot better for them. That was my comment, Dick, back tonight.
Very good stuff, Rich. Now I'm going to amplify what Rich just said. My experience is that when you have a fan-like structure, and I'm not talking about the folded fan-like structure that is the Cobra compact antenna. I'm talking about a pure fan-like dipole. And as you start moving the individual wires super close together, all kinds of funny things start happening real fast. That's my experience. And the analysis and figure out what's happening can be kind of difficult. But with the right kind of instrumentation that displays the data to you the right way in real time, you can do 100 experiments per day instead of 3 experiments per day, so to speak, Joe. So anything you can do to increase that spacing will make your life considerably simpler. The B2RYY, going through one hell of an educational process, K2RYW in the TechNet, and bringing us along with them. You got it, Joe.
Do you have a vector network analyzer?
I used one for 4 hours per day, almost, every day of my life, for the last 10 years, doing a particular kind of work that required it. No, I don't own one. Thank goodness that particular client supplied a beautiful Rohde & Schwarz 0-8 gig vector network analyzer. I have access to a vector network analyzer. I could hand you immediately. That's the good news. In other words, by way of the estate sale, so to speak, of my buddy N2LIV, there is a vector network analyzer sitting there. Nobody in this world, right mind, is going to buy it because it is a very early version of Hewlett-Packard vector network analyzer. I'm going to pick a number, 1985 vintage. Back in those days, they were bulky, clunky, hard to use, hard to calibrate, but they did the job. The modern-day vector network analyzer, which has got tremendous amounts of microprocessor hardware built into it, with the 12-point instantaneous correction program for measuring standing wave ratio or whatever, a modern-day vector network analyzer runs 20 times faster than that clunky thing. But if you just want a pure vector network analyzer, if you're willing to live with some rather ancient piece of equipment, the price is right, Joe. You say it, and it'll appear in your lap.
you've made offers like that to me, I'm going to make an offer like that to you. That'd be DRYY, KQRIW in the TechNet.
Well, I'm not sure what you talk about as far as price. You know, I don't really follow you there. I don't own one of those. I only have the test equipment I have to work with, and pretty much that's it. That's it. So I don't have anything fancy like that to use for this design application. So apparently, I'm going down a road that what I've learned from the greatest thing I've learned from the whole thing is failure. That's what I've learned.
Yeah, but failure is not failure. You know, you've heard that story, which has been exaggerated a little bit, when a reporter interviewed Edison and said, how's it going with you're finding the right material for a light bulb? I've heard tell that you've had 2,500 failures, to which Albert Edison said, I know 2,500 things that don't work. I'm making progress. I'm having success. It's a matter of how you look at it. This clunky, old-fashioned, early vintage Hewlett-Packard vector network analyzer, I told you could have it for a song. In order to make you feel comfortable, I'll put a price on it, $5, and it will appear in your lap. It's the good news. The bad news is that to use it by modern-day standards, you're not going to like it. If you've ever used a modern-day vector network analyzer with all of its beautiful built-in programs and microprocessors that are cranking away, doing all kinds of crazy calculations and displaying it 30 frames per second on that screen, it's so damn fast in the display, you see no flicker. Everything you see is in real time as you're moving things around. This thing that I'm describing to you is nowhere near that good, but that price... go ahead, John.
What model number is it, do you remember?
Oh, I don't, but I can find out pretty fast. But I'll warn you, it's old and clunky. As I said, vector network analyzers, Hewlett-Packard came out with them, I'm going to make a guess, 1970 or so. Around 1970, 73 is where they started coming out with them. This is not their first one, but it's not too many models downrange from their first one. Nowhere near as user-friendly as the modern ones. The modern ones have come such a long way. I started off my career hating vector network analyzers. And a guy named Mark Duran went and bought for me, for the work that I was doing, he bought this Rodin Schwarz thing. And reluctantly I started using it. And within a week I fell in love with it. Over to you, John. Is there an easy way that we can... No, I don't think so. The ball's in my court. I've got to find out the model number. The price is right, but it's not necessarily what you're looking for. I would be reluctant to use it, but maybe you're more enthusiastic than I am, Joe. W-E-2-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W in the TechNet.
Well, with what I mentioned with my test equipment, it's not solving the objectivity of the whole experiment by getting the antenna to be resonant as far as my transmitter is going to see it looking into a single piece of coax cable. That was the object of the game, to make something working on multiple frequencies that had some sort of, you know, realism of being, you know, semi-resonant without having to exercise the hell out of my internal antenna tuner. And I don't plan to use an external antenna tuner with my station. I don't plan to do that. I tried to make the thing work with the internal antenna tuner. So right now, I guess I'm at a standstill. What I have doesn't seem to work properly. So, you know, over to the next guy.
Before we completely give up on this one, Joe, let me suggest something else to you. MFJ and other brands, I can't think of them, AEA or whatever, they make a sweeping antenna analyzer. They make a kind of a ham radio version antenna analyzer where you can tell it start at this frequency, stop at that frequency, display on the screen reflection coefficient, or display on this liquid crystal screen in black and white the standing wave ratio, and that it will display in real time. And so as you now tweak your model antenna, your scale model, you're doing it at high frequencies to prove the concept that you're going to eventually use really on 80 meters. With that machine that you and I could buy, and not that pricey, and maybe even some of them are available on the surplus market,
you now can see a real display, and as you move these wires around with insulated plastic rods or wooden sticks or whatever, skewer sticks, the things that you can buy for doing shish kebab that I see in the supermarket, those are beautiful tuning tools. You can now have no human intervention, so to speak. You're moving the wires around, and by way of this AEA or MFJ thing, you're looking at a real-time display and watching it get good and bad at all the frequencies you care about as you move it around. You can do 100 experiments per day in that manner. I wonder if Hal has ever done things like that. K60PZ, K2RAW, go ahead, Hal.
K2RAW, K60PZ. No, I just wanted to make a comment. It sounded like they were having a swappage shop on the TechNet.
A2JAS. We're not doing anything for profit-making. Ham radio operators are perfectly allowed to buy and sell and trade ham radio pieces of equipment with each other, discuss it over the air. Joe has a problem. He wants a higher analysis. I think he needs better instrumentation. The price is right. I'm offering him a piece of instrumentation. The fact that the TechNet is becoming swap and chop, are you going to hold our feet to the fire to say we're violating the original constitution that we're following? I think we're getting much too legalistic here. Who's the other person that just signed in? K2RAW, go ahead.
Thank you, Rich. This is Roger, K2JAS. Are you copying me?
K2JAS. Roger, I'm copying you very well. Please proceed, sir.
Okay. Good evening, gentlemen, all of you. I wanted to say hello to Hal. Spoken to, but I have been reading about your exploit, so I'm with you 100%, even though I am still a pilot, and I have my own plane, and I know what you're going through. But my reason for coming on tonight was to ask Rich a very quick and simple that had to do with amplifier power, but I will wait till the discussion allows that to take place. So let me turn it back over to Hal.
Okay, Roger, good hearing you on. And if there's questions about amplifiers, I could chime in on that with Dick Webster. Dick, I was pulling your chain a little bit.
It turns out to Hal, what you did is perfectly legal, so to speak. What you said is very logical. You hit a soft spot to me. There have been a very small number of people who said the way this TechNet is run is much too loose. It's not regimented enough. You should be setting an exact hour that you start at exactly 8 o'clock, stop at exactly 9 o'clock with just the general questions. Then you go over to the mailbag at 9 o'clock to exactly 9:20. There's been a number of people who have said those words, that we're violating the original intent of the TechNet if we didn't follow that exact formula. And I object to that strongly. If we happen to get into a hot and heavy discussion with everybody having enthusiasm, and it goes, instead of beyond 9 o'clock, it goes to 10:30 on just the early question point, I'm going to go with the flow and let people do it. When people have enthusiasm, when they've got curiosity, I'm not going to squelch it by somebody's exact set of rules. That's my philosophy of life. If you don't like it, run your own TechNet. I'm exaggerating, if you know what I mean. So, Joe, you have, by way of that AEA or that antenna analyzer, MFJ or whatever, a number of these handheld, not too expensive antenna analyzers that give you a display of reflection coefficient in real time. And if you could watch it in real time while you're moving the wires, you're going to get a huge leg up on a lot of experiments in a hurry that even if it's difficult to explain what's happening, by doing all of those experiments, by the laws of physics, you're going to eventually hit some pay dirt and you're going to say, I'm not quite sure what's going on here. Is it directional coupler? Is it transmission line characteristics? Is it radiation characteristics? Is it a mixture of all the above? I'll analyze it later. I'll find the solution now by using that display. I'll tweak with it and I say, hey, that works. Now I'll build a repeater.
Time out.
Once you find that solution, you'll say, now I'll build a scaled up version. You see the philosophy that I'm advocating here, Joe. I'm telling you what I've done for the last 10 years. For me, it was extremely successful. Not everybody's going to agree with me on this one. W2LYY, K2L,
did I have some information on that analyzer.
Okay, maybe you know the one I'm talking about. Go ahead, John.
If you Google up, somebody just dropped a note in the chat room. If you Google up Array Solutions, an AIM-4300 is probably what he would be looking for. No price listed, but if he Googles that up, he'll be able to get the information. Array Solutions.
Array Solutions. Now, AIM-4300, is that the model number of a piece of hardware that we can purchase for some reasonable price? AIM-4300? Give me a few more words on this one, John. Over to you, John, K2REW.
Dick, I don't know the price, have no idea, but if he goes on the website, he'll be able to get the price and see if it's something reasonable, and that'll do the job for him. A couple of manufacturers that make them, but this one we've got good information on.
K2MMY, I'd like to make a comment.
KC2MMY, go right ahead, sir.
Hey, Dick and John, it's Ray. I just wanted to make put on the side note, I guess, I think people don't know, I mean, a lot about radio, so they don't know what to ask as far as the questions, and that's why lots of times it comes down to antennas. You know, like this, mixers, ring modulators, how the actual radio works, the IF, decibels, I just wrote some stuff down here. What else can I say? I don't know. Phase lock loops, things like that, mixers. So a suggestion would be, like, sometimes, you know how Craig, he actually brings a subject with him to the astronomy net because he knows people don't know what to ask. So just a suggestion, maybe somewhere in the tech net, you can think about it, do what you want, you mostly run it. But, you know, that maybe we could bring up a subject that's, you know, different or, I'm not bored with antennas at all. I'm just saying people don't know, you know, what to necessarily ask, and it might be something interesting that could be brought to it as a matter of its function. That's all I want to say. K2MMY, clear.
Price info, Dick.
Okay, get back to John in a second. I understand what you're saying, Ray. And Ray, you've done the first step of what's required. You've made a list. Made a list of the things that you would like to know more about. Phase lock loops, directional couplers, transmission lines, computer controlled receiver techniques, and so on. You've already made a list. You're welcome to go down that list and say, this is the one I care about most right now, this is the one I care about second. And week after week, you're allowed to ask those questions, Ray. Ray, I'm putting the ball back into your court. In other words, you know there's a list of subjects that quite a few people would like to know about. You've got them on that piece of paper in front of you. What's stopping you from asking us those exact questions week after week? KC2MMY, K2RIW, I'm putting a challenge on you, Ray.
Roger that, Dick. I mean, I know a little about radio, so I kind of have an idea about what to ask. But there's people out there, lots of them on the tech net, they don't know how radio even works, what the components are. You know, mixing, IF, you know, local oscillator, this kind of thing. They don't know what to ask. So the first thing that comes to mind, you know, a lot of what comes to mind is the antenna because, you know, people think a radio needs an antenna. What can I do with the antenna? There's so many, many other subjects. What I'm saying is, with your knowledge, you could trigger questions by just a couple of words. You could start trigger a whole bunch of mentality. And yes, Dick, I do try to ask these questions. You know me, I try to get in there with all kind of different questions when I can. But then, you know, there's a lot of people, so I try to get in early, you know, when I can. You know, I'm just saying it would help, it's a technique to trigger people to think about what could be asked. That's what I'm saying.
Sounds like a good suggestion, Ray. I'll try. Alrighty. By way of the fact that the TechNet runs for 4 solid hours, and therefore there's a lot of time for people to ask a lot of questions, up till now my philosophy has been the majority should come from what's on the guy's mind right now. They're reading an article and they don't understand it. They've done an experiment in the backyard. They don't understand it. They had a discussion on the air, and somebody said such and such. What did he mean by that? You know, and, I've let the main subjects each night be user supplies as opposed to me acting like a lecturer. Of the complaints that people give me, that I'm trying to be a lecturer all the time. I'm too long-winded, without a doubt.